You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded late in the evening of the 15th of March, 2025. I want to remind you guys of the project I'm doing with Peter Kihonis on Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together. We're going through the entire book. We're already on, episode 20. We're going through the entire book piece by piece and analyzing it in various ways. I strongly recommend you check it out if you haven't already. I'm going to be on the Dark Enlightenment show the end of the month, I think. I've been with him before on the radio. He's a good guy. But if you have heard the latest episode of the Solzhenitsyn Project, you can hear in the background my cat, well, kitten, Chubba Purdy. She's a deaf, purebred Turkish Angora who, because she's deaf, doesn't know how loud she is. And you could hear her in the background. So somebody, a friend of ours, I guess it was on YouTube, said, "This is based and kitty-pilled." Kitty pill. I don't know who that guy is, but he has coined the term. Chubba Purdy is the cat's name. Not nearly as famous as his orange big brother Stanley, but probably more ideologically committed on our side. So, again, you may hear him at any random time, but the kitty pill is now an increasingly important concept. Not as important as Johnson's Law. But yes, her name is Chubba Purdy, named after the football player who I thought was going to Nebraska and has made a million commitments in college. He's the 49ers quarterback's brother. Anyway, that has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today. And I don't know how far we're going to get here. But we're going to talk about today is a natural or seemingly natural alliance between Germany and Russia. There's a book that I was sent by a friend of mine that separates Germany from the West, giving it more of a Russian and Eastern feel than a Western one, the West being typified by the Low Countries and Britain and France. But this is entitled Natural Allies Against the Postmodern: Historic Relationship Between Russia and Germany. Alexander Dugin, many others, talk about the natural alliance on many bases of Russia and Germany, and how obsessed the British were in the years leading up to World War I and making sure that that alliance never came to pass. But Russia and Germany always had a very special relationship. Now, I should also note that Mikhail Nazarov, the head of the Union of the Russian People, the old Black Hundred organization, is also working on this. In fact, he inspired me to do this. He inspires me much of the time. He's one of the best writers in Russia now. He's working on a far more in-depth version of this. Father George Titov, as well, has done this relative to Austria-Hungary. It's pretty clear that Germany and Russia, you know, they're both land powers. They have complementary national characters. And up until 1917, had a strong kinship between the ruling dynasties. And also, they had a sense of mission, an aspect of the Roman heritage. and it played a very important role, both in the events and the catastrophes of the 20th century, but events that were set up by outsiders. This show is called The Orthodox Nationalist, maybe the Russian Orthodox Nationalist. Nationalism is very important. Nationalism doesn't necessarily negate the concept of an empire, but it certainly negates the concept of feudal fragmentation. God created the world with a single plan, a single idea, life, the kingdom of God, eternal life. But after our ancestors showed disobedience and sought after power and fantasy, many different nations with different religions and outlooks emerged. But we have to understand that they may be equal in terms of public policy, they certainly are not in relation to God and his post-lapsarian plan for history, for mankind. And this plan is based around, St. Augustine said, an absolute criterion, truth, logos. It's not my truth or your truth, it's truth. But truth, by its definition, can only be singular, at least in essence. That also means that peoples, both as collectives and individuals, can be closer to this truth than others. In fact, many groups will actively resist it under the influence of its opposite, falsehood, fantasy, the realm of demons. So that means there is a coordinate system, as Nazarov said, between the poles of good and evil. Again, as St. Augustine said, and that's how history can be understood. Truth does not develop in essence. Of course, it always gains detail and nuance over time. And it's important to note there is no such thing as a neutral vacuum. There's no beyond good and evil. But the concept of writing a history or being a historian seems to imply this divine truth. Otherwise, why would you do history? That would simply be a list of events. Rulers, civil strife, foreign wars, whatever, without any meaning behind it. History is just a list of dates. But without this truth, without this goal, history then, if it's done at all, becomes distorted. Meaning has to be imposed on it from outside, like the end of history thesis, or Karl Marx's conception of history. So if there is a single God, there is a single truth. That also means there's a single ideal for humanity in the world. Further, means the existence of different nations and religions, so to speak, can only be explained by the fact that different parts of humanity realize this truth in varying degrees. The criterion, of course, is logos, both the source and the essence of all that is. To move away, this is a zero-sum game, to move away from God's truth means to draw closer to the demonic plan to establish Lucifer's earthly kingdom. So we're working with absolutes here, two poles, and these two poles, these two opposites, are a means whereby we can understand the natural history and the national history of each individual nation, as well as their place in this human history. Now, let's be clear. The differences amongst nations are not in and of themselves an obstacle to spiritual unity or in relation to God's truth. As the ancients always did, different ethnic groups had their own churches, had their own everything. But it is also the case that specific ethnic groups have been chosen above others. We also have to know that linguistic differences, the very creation of nations, were created by God, but after the fall, it was to prevent the spread of evil. It was a result of man's desire to be like God in his construction of the Tower of Babel. Evil revolves around this Promethean ideal. The opposite, of course, is the divine intervention in giving the apostles the gift of speaking all languages to spread that one truth to everyone, rather than having a single language that everyone could understand. That's, as I've said before, is a huge distinction. The apostles began to preach not one language that somehow could be magically understood by everybody, but their own. They spoke in whatever languages they knew, and the hearers understood them in their own language. That's a enormous statement. The religious differences that arose after the Tower of Babel, those reflect choices that national elites made within this very system of spiritual coordinates, between the plan of God on the one side and that of his adversary, Satan, Set, Prometheus, Lucifer, whatever. It's the same principle. God created man, but he didn't create a turtle. Man is not self-sufficient. You know, turtles don't have families. Man is not closed on his own selfhood, but man is inherently a social being. And our development and maturation is possible only within an interaction with our own kind, based on mutual responsibility. The very existence of the first person plural in our language suggests this means of communication. The concept of morality is a system. This is a spiritual language of relationships with others speaking the same language. If the individual was truly self-sufficient, then there would be no reason for language. And it's also that error is the origin of nominalism's falsehood. Nations are conciliar personalities. I don't like the word collective. They're conciliar personalities. The individual comes into existence only as a link, linked by mutual responsibility for good and evil. Ultimately, it's moral. The Apostle Paul says, if one member suffers, then all the members suffer with it. If one is honored, all the members rejoice, in 1 Corinthians. With this kind of conciliar understanding, this explains the nature of the sins of our fathers, not to mention original sin. And, on the positive side, the ability to atone, some representatives of the people for others, for the entire nation, including the sacrifice of the God-man for all of mankind. Nations are usually taken for granted in the ancient world, and scriptures being a part of that ancient world, but they are spoken of. They're spoken of as entities that are morally responsible, almost personae, figures in history. The very fact that the promise to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation, I will make of you a father of many nations, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice, in Genesis 22. Now what opposes that? The desire for earthly power, the rule of the passions to dominate others in one form or another. That's the ultimate betrayal of the nation. The ultimate rejection, the ultimate betrayal is rejection of the kingdom of heaven. We hear this, of course, at the crucifixion. Crucify him, crucify him. Let his blood be on us and our children, both in Matthew and Luke. Pontius Pilate did everything in his power to allow Christ to go free. There's a Jewish Pharisees that, once they ran out of things to say, had to say, we're going to go to Caesar with this if you don't do what we say. Even, you know, giving him, you know, Barabbas as a possibility. It was almost an obsessive drive. And from that comes the fulfillment of the prophecy. The kingdom of God will be taken from you, he's referring to the Jews, or the, you know, and given to a nation worthy of its fruits, Matthew 21. And then, of course, the obvious one, Christ instructs the apostles, go and teach all nations. Now, at the end of earthly history, we will have the final judgment. That is over nations, as well as individuals. The prophet Joel says, I will gather all nations, and I will execute judgment on them for my people's sake. In the book of Matthew, all nations shall be gathered before him. You're talking about the judgment, of course. But each one has its own historical path. The Lord has suffered all nations to go their own way in Acts 14. Revelation 15, all nations will come and worship before you, for your judgments have been revealed. And I could multiply these. But they mean really two things. First, that all nations are given the natural law, a single law of life by God. And secondly, by virtue of the very difficult path of free will. Free will is a moral conquest. It's very difficult. Both the individual and the nation can deviate from natural law in different ways. Realizing the law of death, up to and including the conscious rejection of God. So in the drama of earthly history, and it is certainly dramatic, it is the struggle of the forces of good and evil under conditions of personal freedom. Personal freedom, again, autonomy, being able to think clearly and put aside the passions of self-interest, that's hard to do. Now, Nabokovnadzor came up with something, you know, it's interesting. It's what he calls the periodic table of nations. We're looking at this massive diversity of thousands of large and small nations, not just today, but historically. And there has to be a way to plot their position, depending on the degree to which they fulfill God's law or depart from it. And we talk about nations, we're talking about elite rule. There's always rebellion against it, or at least a possibility. So the vertical axis is the space between God above and Satan below. Now, I don't want this to give the impression that Satan somehow is an independent actor. He would love you to believe that. No, we read in the book of Job that he, without wanting to know it, operates on God's orders. God allows him to do things. He allowed Satan to torment Job, for example. That's the vertical axis. The horizontal one is the space between the image of God and man, which is natural law, even pagan societies have. In Romans, we read, you know, Gentiles, they do not have the law by nature, they do what the law requires. The work of the law is written in their hearts. That's the concept of natural law. It's an aspect of human nature. And of course, the opposite, the perversion of the image of God, the maximum degree of contempt, either conscious or not, ultimately leading to the Antichrist. So the regime, the left, and the Antichrist under Jewish rule, the rule of Adam Kadmon. And we could talk about this in, you know, non-Christian peoples relative to natural law, and the prophets laid out that criteria too. So the closest to God's plan are those who preserve the Orthodox faith, undistorted by any kind of innovation or self-interest. Orthodoxy in all of its difficulty. Ultimately, it fell to the Slavs to take over that from the Roman Empire, the Romans and Greeks. And Russia created a state very close to what human beings are capable of in terms of God's plan for earthly history. So it took over its restraining force against the world's evil, as Paul says, preventing chaos in the construction of the kingdom of Antichrist. The most distant is self-conscious rejection of God, becoming an instrument of Satan by one's own decision. Of course, they wouldn't call him Satan. They'd call him Lucifer, Prometheus, or whatever, you know, label they use is the same thing. The drive to establish the kingdom of Antichrist on earth. Jews, of course, being a central. The rejection of logos is their very nature, manifest in the Talmud, which is, you know, Satanism. The Messiah, so-called, that they're waiting for, is something that's going to establish their rule and put us, those who are allowed to continue to exist, in slavery. This Jewish national leader, under whom all the wealth of the world will flow to the Jews, anyone else who doesn't serve them will be destroyed. Now, there's a lot of nations in between. So, Nazarov notes the English-speaking world, which is always tough to talk about since I'm part of that. So are you. Talk about the Roman Empire as being the foundation, infrastructural foundation for the gospel. It's not an accident. Christ came in this empire that established tremendously rapid communication. The opposite of that would be the English language, unfortunately. British, or the Judeo-British, this has nothing to do with actual Anglo-Saxons. Spread of English, the spread of the empire, the spread of the regime. The British elite saddled by Jewry, and that was formed. And the combination of Freemasonry and leftism eventually became the USA, the crystallization of the Jewish spirit, in the words of Werner Sombart, the stronghold of the anti-Christian world, the basis, at least the physical basis, for building the kingdom of Antichrist. I mean, Freemasonry is just Judaism for non-Jews. Very much typical of that Machiavellian mentality, where in the early degrees, you don't really know what's coming later. We've spoken about that on this show before. And of course, after the 33rd, of course, there are many degrees after that that are non-Masonic. Crowley, you know, had, I think, 108, whatever it was. But this is just a manifestation of the Judaizing spirit. Freemasonry became an instrument of Jewry and the Judaization of the world, using London and now New York as one of its physical foundations. So you have the Christian restraining force on the one hand and the apostate force. Now, what does this have to do with Russia and Germany? Well, at the beginning of the Middle Ages, Western Europeans were part of a single universal church. They were part of the ecumenical councils, common church teaching, common fathers. But something happened. And it's very easy to get sloganeery about this. 1054 was one thing out of many, lasted quite a while before, you know, grace was finally withdrawn. Nothing magical happened in 1054. It took quite a while. But however you want to call it, you know, pride, power, this demonic temptation, eventually, at least the very latest would be 1204, break with orthodoxy to various mundane forms of Christianity, and eventually itself becoming the disaster of disasters, the Reformation. Now, the Germans had a rivalry, not only with the First Rome, but with the Second Rome as well in the 10th century. There was an attempt to restore the Western Roman Empire, the Drang nach Osten, the move to the East. But there was a time where, rather than cooperating with the Russians, and there were many examples of this in the Petersburg period of Russian history, they allowed themselves to be pitted against Russia in mutually destructive and fratricidal wars that destroyed European manhood. The end of the Middle Ages was marked by the emergence of Judaized Christianity. One of the manifestations of that was a more radical Protestantism that had the criterion of wealth as being chosen of God, or a mark of chosenness. Which, I don't want to go so far as to, like Nazarov says, it gives birth to modern capitalism. No, it created a new stage. You know, capitalism is a function of decay. But the widespread establishment under the British Empire, the Protestant capitalist mentality, the positive qualities of the European peoples, and especially the German, began to be used by their rulers for selfish global expansion. French were classic examples of this. To this day, the French Revolution is the foundation of this debased nation, which has an extraordinary and wonderful past. It was deep Freemasonry, and the chain reaction that came from 1789 led to a series of bourgeois revolutions. But it did crash against the Russian colossus. The Masonic invasion of Napoleon is a direct product of the French Revolution. But if Russia and Germany are natural allies, then, I mean, outside of the obvious question of the Jews, the opposite of the Russo-German alliance would be the Anglo-American. The fact that Judaism, which has controlled the world's financial and economic activity for a very long time, they settled and chose the British as this, you know, talented, courageous, and enterprising people. And that was the base, the Anglo-American Imperium, for expanding Judaic control. So in America, you had the rise of two opposing global forces. It collided with each other. God-bearing Russian civilization and the apostate Anglo-Jewish one. We know who controlled the anti-Russian revolutionary movement, and we know who controls the violence, or the obsessive violence, of the anti-Russian movement today. Today's Europe has gone to the point where they don't even mention Christianity as an integral part of its history. We all know what's happening. The fag marriages, euthanasia, drugs, and possibly, worst of all, the invasion of hostile migrants. The sole purpose of which, not only is to lower wages, but to have a reserve army to use against people like me, people like you. So the historically Orthodox peoples of Eastern Europe, Bulgarians, Romanians, Greeks, Serbs, today, to a great extent, have succumbed to the pan-European values. Although, of course, there's a remnant that remains. The official churches, as we all know, have a neo-Orthodox, trying to find a niche in the Great Reset. Earthly domination is the fulfillment of the powerful lusts of Satan, who ultimately has chosen Jews as his instrument. That's what opposes the Orthodox Slavs, and in particular, the old Russian monarchy, which is why I started this talking about what we're doing with Solzhenitsyn. Because in a very real way, this is his argument there. The Israelites, I'm not talking about Jews here, I'm talking about the Old Testament people. They were patiently raised, they weren't chosen, they were raised by God to proclaim through them to humanity, sick with sin, the meaning of history, and to eventually incarnate the Savior of humanity. This people is a constant object of Satan's attempt to take them from God, and even at their best often fell into demon worship. But when Christ was murdered, the bulk of these people, to the influence of their high priest, fell into the same satanic temptation of earthly power. Christ was seen as a competitor. He chose the path of death. Christ said, "Another will come in his own name. Him you will receive," in John 5. "Your father is the devil," John 8. Christ did not mince words here. The Jewish rejection, the Logos, that's when the Christian era of history began. The universal church became the successor of the people of God, absorbing the best of all nations who want to follow the path of life with God. However, in history, of course, not all nations are partakers of the church. They remain ignorant of the saving truth and captive to satanic, to one degree or another, beliefs and ideals. But even Christian nations, united in that church, still remain conciliar individuals in earthly history. They preserve their national differences. While some succeed in embodying the divine law in their state life to a greater extent, others, to a lesser extent, they could also reject it. The core peoples in this schema, the Israelites, the Old Testament Jews, first of all, who expected and recognized Christ, almost all the apostles accepted a martyr's death for this. But they gave an example of the ascetic path to other people, converting them. The Greeks, of course, secondly, became the first Christian state-forming people of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. That they preserved the first Orthodox universal empire, the Second Rome, in the 3rd to the 15th centuries. They were the most cultured people of Europe at the time. The insular Irish would be a close second. But the Greeks, in their fight against old and new anti-Christian philosophical temptations and heresies, developed the foundation of church teaching and what we know as Christian statehood. But it was a bloody battle. First millennium, the bulk of Roman emperors, Byzantine emperors, were heretics. And they tried to impose their heresy on the population. It is a miracle, and I mean that word literally, that Orthodoxy as we know it ever emerged victorious. Thirdly, of course, the noble virtues of the Greeks, once they came crashing down, had to be brought to a new people. The Russians became the successor as an integral church party office since the 10th century. The Empire of the Second Rome then, after the Second Rome's fall in 1453, as a state-forming people, the successor of the Orthodox Ecumenical Empire, i.e. the Third Rome. In a manner of speaking, it was the perfection of Orthodox statehood. The fall of the Third Rome, beginning in the 20th century, occurred, like all of these, occurred due to the sins of its ruling class. That the Jews, Romans, the Greeks, the sins of the leading class of the people, burdened the entire nation, recognizing this power in a form of collective responsibility. Germans played an enormous role in this. The center of European Christian civilization. It's one of the reasons for so long I was very interested in the Western Rite of Orthodoxy. For 1,000 years, these rites and rituals were used. They were very ethnic. There was a tremendous diversity within them. The schism of Old Rome, almost around that very same time, at least within a century, ended up destroying or trying to destroy those ancient rituals and then centralizing power, not only in terms of its bishop, but liturgically as well. The role of the Germans was extremely positive. In other words, it's essentially conservative and the very opposite of the English. I mean, just a few examples. The Germans opposed the Judaization of Freemasonry more than other Western European nations. At the end of the 19th century, you had a broad national resistance to Jewish influence in the economy and the culture, which the Jews, you know, call anti-Semitism. The German people preserved a very strong national monarchy in both German central powers right up to the First World War. The Germans gave the Russian Empire many talented figures who became sincere Orthodox patriots later on. After the First World War, Germany led the European resistance to the Geo-Masonic victors, which is another way of talking about Adolf Hitler. There's a reason that he arose in Germany and not elsewhere. The big problem, of course, is that so much of this resistance was based on a very ecumenical or even non-Christian foundation. So even the best of the German virtues, you know, rational order, conscientiousness, connected as they were with a strong patriarchal national ideal of duty, ended up being misled. That Germany is a target of the regime, not just after World War I, of course, after World War II as well. It wasn't just that the German government had to be defeated. Germany had to be completely destroyed. It's also no accident that nationalism as a philosophical school found its roots in German Romanticism of the 19th century, leading to German unification. But even the best virtues, if not in the right context, can lead to destruction. The ideologists of modern globalism, people like Jacques Attali, former president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, he said that stated that, you know, around World War I, Jewish bankers in different European countries, they may have had their own agenda, but in one thing, they were united. American Jews entered an agreement with all others to regard Tsarist Russia as the only country against which war must be waged. Now, once that monarchy fell to the Bolsheviks, the last hope, of course, was the Third Reich, as problematic as it was in many ways. Probably the most short-sighted policy in European history is the German monarchy feeding credits and money to the revolutionaries in Russia. Now, the money wasn't German. It came from Jewish banks in the USA. I mean, Jewish bankers organized the financing of all external enemies of the of Russia and the internal revolutionary forces. But of course, they were doing the same thing to Germany. People like Alexander Israel Gelfand Parvus, massive propaganda campaign in the press, the organization of all kinds of unrest and strikes, explosion of railway bridges and oil fields, etc. German money didn't finance revolutionaries. Germany was simply a conduit. And what was done to Germany at the end of World War I was tripled at the end of World War II. It's a miracle that there is a Germany at all. Russia was winning World War I, contrary to the mythology. The February Revolution stopped it. This was organized by the liberal Masonic Duma opposition, the encouragement of the Entente, especially the British, to take victory away. Had the Tsar defeated the Germans, and that whole thing was so artificial, they were fighting in the first place, Russia today would be a nation of a billion people. Lloyd George, the British Parliament, was very clear how the overthrow of the Russian Tsar was one of his main goals. He even said the British government is confident that these events, meaning the overthrow of the monarchy, begin a new era in the history of the world, being the first victory of the principles for which we begin the war. The Daily News, talking about and commenting on Lloyd George's statement, said, "The February Revolution, the greatest of all the victories won by the Allies to date, that revolution incomparably more important than the victory at the front." You should also note that both Russia and Germany had a strong idea of being chosen or set aside for a universal purpose. The messianic idea. Now, the concept of messianic thinking tend to have their own version of it. There is a proud type, of course, the Jews. Although I don't think the concept of chosenness in the Jews has really a religious connotation anymore. Jews are self-chosen, believing themselves as the light of the world. And therefore, the real Messiah must appear as part of the Jewish nation. Precisely because Christ did not come in the guise of an earthly king, but a very humble herald of love, the Son of God, he came for others other than the Jews. Messianic thinking amongst Jews changed very radically. But the word Messiah, just translated into Greek by the word Christ. Hence, the word is built in to Christianity. What it comes down to is a highly obligatory and difficult struggle in following Messiah of Christ himself. And the Third Rome is very much a part of this. This isn't pride whatsoever. Orthodoxy imposes the most difficult duties. That's often almost impossible to fulfill. We all know that. Orthodox people who are listening to me know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a burden, but it's justified as love for the Creator, necessary for spiritual growth. But you had also had people like Wagner, Wolfgang Menzel, even Fichte calling Germany the John Germans, the primordial people. The pan-human idea, just like the Russians had. Hegel, the greatest philosopher of the 19th century, considered the German nation to be a chosen, embodying universal historical ideal, the highest expression of the human spirit. And there's much of brilliance in Hegel. So much of the Slavophile movement came, at least at its foundations, from Germany. I'm studying the German Romantics since I was getting my MA at St. Louis. That's why I did my master thesis on Hegel. The Russians took him and ran with him. I think I've quoted before the archpriest George Titov, who's a specialist in the late 19th, early 20th century German national ideology. I'm going to quote him here. Charlemagne is the completion and the beginning. In him is the completion of the work of Pippin and St. Boniface. In him is the beginning of the universal Western Empire in the Christian unity of the West, the Western Civitas Christiana. At the same time, the beginning of the future German imperial power of the Middle Ages. Without Charlemagne, there would have been no unification of the German tribes, who had until then been constantly fighting among themselves as strangers, and therefore there would have been no proclamation in the West as a Roman Empire. This, of course, later became known as the Empire of the German Nation. Consequently, there would have been no brilliant imperial reign, along with all of its church and historical problems. He goes on to say that the differences in the spiritual structure of Eastern and Western Christians at the time were not as profound as they became later. In fact, in this era, what we now know as Germany was Orthodox and anti-papal throughout most of the Byzantine era. And this grew and became distinctive for the German national ideology. Fortunately, the Reformation did tremendous damage to this. It led to tremendous distortion, not just in theology, but in politics as well. Germany, quite often, under the empire, was an ally of Byzantium. They were constantly at war with Rome. And it was problems in southern Europe that exploded into Protestantism. At the beginning of the 20th century in Russia, however, the concept of restraining a third Rome was interpreted politically too. The unification of the German states was national and political, reflected both in the philosophy of German idealism and Romanticism, which I tend to associate together anyway. The difference, though, I mean, look, German Romanticism was their war on the Enlightenment. Herder being chief among them, finding itself in Hegel, finding its terminus in Hegel, I should say. It would be very controversial, but Hegel is so difficult, you know, reading him is a podvig in and of itself. One of the other very powerful things that Germany and Russia had in common was the nature of what we call feudal fragmentation. Fragmentation of any large nation is caused by the sinful lust for power, the egotism of its princes that don't want to submit to any one central source of unity. This kind of fragmentation not only physically weakens the nation in the face of external threats, but hinders their spiritual awareness of their mission in history, their purpose, their duty to God. The empire has a divine mission as an organization of a nation for defense against global evil. The same thing for the pre-Christian Universal Roman Empire. This was accepted by the apostles. The Russian and German Christian peoples, Orthodox for a long time in the West, retained an awareness of the importance of the empire and tried, to the extent of their talents, to become its successors. The main sin, both in Russia and Germany, was the power of the appanage princes, the tendency to devolve, competing with each other. Now, the German principalities, that was supplemented by their rivalry with the Church of Rome, which also laid claim, of course, to earthly power. The result in the West was not just feudal fragmentation and absolutism, as a morally unlimited power of monarchs, but a distortion of the essence of Christianity, of course, especially in the Reformation, which grew in Germany from his motives of protest against the abuses of the Roman clergy. The Reformation became yet another obstacle to unification. The Peace of Westphalia in 1648, after the Thirty Years' War, consolidated, rather than tried to fix, the political fragmentation of the Reich. What, you had 300 small states at the time? In 870, under Louis the German, the East Frankish kingdom united almost all lands inhabited by German speakers. In 936, under the great King Otto I, he proclaimed himself the Holy Roman Emperor and Empire. Its core was the German lands. It wasn't reflected necessarily in the name at the time. But in 1512, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Maximilian I, changed the name, reflecting its ethnic and German basis, the Holy Roman Empire of the German Nation. And this testifying to the German awareness not only of their imperial mission as Rome's successor, but also of the formation of a German national consciousness striving for the unity of all German speakers. So it's right to call it the First German Reich, still fragmented, unfortunately. The same problem existed in Russia. Feudal fragmentation in the Kievan era had the same reason, the same problem. It was the lust for power of these princes. In Russia, though, you had the Orthodox Church seeking to reconcile them and did not, in and of itself, lay any claim to earthly power. Now, the Horde brought everyone to their senses. The Horde, wherever you think they came from, show just how weak this fragmentation really was and what kind of damage it causes. The Russian nation not only overcame political fragmentation in the creation of a centralized, autocratic state around the new capital in Moscow, but also in the process realized the religious meaning of their existence as the restraining successor of the Second Rome, being its province since the 10th century. That consciousness was preserved in Russia throughout the Moscow period until the westernizing reforms of Peter I. By the middle of the 18th century, two large states emerged among the many German states, Prussia and Austria, the ancestral possession of the Habsburg dynasty, which became the ruling dynasty of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation in 1438. The problem, of course, is that eventually you're going to be dealing with two different religions. Unlike the other German principalities, Austria expanded at the expense of non-German people, especially the Slavs, Italians, and Hungarians. The problems associated with this distracted the attention and strength of the Habsburgs from pan-German affairs. That's where Prussia came to the forefront, especially by the middle of the 18th century. 1701, Prussian Elector Frederick III proclaimed himself King of Prussia, turning the Duchy of Prussia into a kingdom that was not part of the Holy Roman Empire, though some of the territories under the Prussian king were part of it. In the wars of the 18th century, Prussia expanded significantly as a result of the conquests of Silesia from the Habsburgs, the seizure of the Baltic coast from the Swedes, and of course later the partitions of Poland. By Napoleon's era, and the wars that followed, Prussia, though subordinated to Napoleon for a time, became one of the major European powers, competing with Austria for influence in German affairs. The Holy Roman Empire of the German nation ceased to exist after Napoleon defeated Austria in the War of 1805. 1806, Francis II resigned the title of emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, yet remained the emperor of Austria. The German principality united into the Confederation of the Rhine, where Napoleon, I guess, was the absolute but de facto ruler. The significance here is that the number of German states shrunk to about 38, including Prussia and the German part of Austria. The Austrian Empire, with 27 million people, was numerically superior to Prussia. But Prussia had the advantage of a population, maybe 10 million at the time, that was German-speaking, not to mention the industrial potential on the Rhine. Napoleon's dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation and his formation of the Rhine Confederation, which, note, is a very non-national, non-religious concept, did not alter or extinguish the desire of the best of the German nation to unite into an autocratic Reich. In fact, it did the opposite. It aroused such a natural patriotic ideal present in the ideas of German Romanticism. Don't forget, the Russian Tsars of the Petersburg era, they had a tremendous amount of German blood within them due to dynastic marriages with various German ruling houses. Germany was not foreign, something that Emperor Alexander I confirmed in 1815, since he created the Holy Alliance, the main German monarchs. Alexander considered the close unity of the German states in the then German Union to be very important for overall European well-being. Its federal assembly worked under the chairmanship of a representative of Austria, since the abolished Holy Roman Empire was also headed by Austrian emperors. 1834, the German Customs Union was created, included all major German states, with the exception of Austria. In March 1848, the revolutionary demonstrations that swept across Germany and France and Austria had a demand for united Germany. May of 1848, the National All German Assembly, the Frankfurt Parliament, so-called, met on the initiative of the liberals, but it was soon dispersed. The following year, Prussian King Frederick Wilhelm IV convened a conference at which he proclaimed the Prussian Union, joined by 29 German states. Austria then concluded an agreement with Prussia in the joint management of German affairs. This was, you know, this gets underrated in terms of its significance. The Federal Assembly of the former German Confederation was reconvened in Frankfurt. Unfortunately, Prussia did not recognize it. Everyone knew that the two German states were steadily moving towards war. 1850, November, clash between Prussian and Bavarian troops occurred near Fulda. But who intervened? Tsar Nicholas I, forcing Prussia not to interfere with the decisions of the all-German body in Frankfurt. As a result, Prussia, under military pressure from Austria and Russia, submitted, abandoned any attempts to dictate its will to all Germans. Austria could not become a leader in the unification of Germany due to its internal and external conflicts, but Austria had plenty of supporters of a greater German unification. The Austrian state was very different. It was unbalanced. It was very humane, but deeply divided ethnically. This was not a problem with Prussia. As we all know, Wilhelm I became King of Prussia in 1861, and we know who he appointed in 1862. Yes, Bismarck had no specific plan, but he continually moved towards the goal of a united Germany. The victory in the Danish-Prussian War of 1864, Austrian troops then occupied Holstein, etc., etc. Prussia's allies were the North German states, Hamburg, Bremen, etc. Austria's allies were, of course, Bavaria, Hanover, Baden, Frankfurt, but really only Saxony was willing to put up any men. The Prussians continued to rout. July 3rd, 1866, the Austrian army was defeated. According to the Prague Peace Treaty, 1866, the result of Prussia's victory was Austria's withdrawal from the German Confederation. It had played a leading role up until this point. What was created in its place was the North German Confederation. Of course, the annexation of Schleswig-Holstein. German nationalism was developed as a reaction to the Enlightenment, as a reaction to the French Revolution, of which Hegel was a part, wasn't particularly religious. It didn't have even that older Roman identity. It didn't have the concept of the Christian idea as a matter of history. The German nation had been present in the Holy Roman Empire. It had been Orthodox at one point. Resistance to the Enlightenment, precisely at the time we're talking about here, you know, the political and military stuff on the one side, intellectual stuff on the other. Unification of Germany took place within the resistance to the Enlightenment. Romanticism was very significant, but religious differences were a huge problem. In Germany, the new Prussian nationalism came to compete, or really actually came to total dominance, 1866, 1870. The problem with it was that it meant the destruction of the old imperial ideal, a break with the thousand-year tradition. This is not the sort of nationalism that is constructive. It meant the denial of Germany's essence, the subordination, and surrender of the Catholic parts of Germany to the completely Protestant spirit of the Prussians, the Lutheran spirit of the Prussians. Even people like Hildebrand, let me quote him directly here. "Only the Austro-Hungarian monarchy remained faithful as the only state in Europe, the old international tradition. Only here did a statehood survive in which religion, history, and dynasty were united forming forces. Only here did we encounter an empire. Since the second Hohenzollern German Empire was an empire only in name, in reality, it was a purely narrow-minded national state with a completely civic nationalist ideology." He says nationalist, but he's referring to what we call civic nationalist. After the war, 1866, the Treaty of Prague that year. Bavaria, Württemberg, Hesse-Darmstadt, Baden, about 6 million people total. Regulated relations with the North German Confederation. Very, essentially a social contract. In terms, if there was an external aggressor, they were to unite their armies. But the inhabitants of the southern German states, we all know, are Catholics, and they showed no desire to unite with the Lutherans of the north. Franco-Prussian War, of course, changed things. All these obstacles were overcome, this general patriotic enthusiasm of the Germans. The French saw Prince Leopold invited by the Spanish to take over, and the French saw this as a threat. French foreign minister, in fact, declared in Parliament that the French Empire would never hesitate to start a war against Prussia if it dared to resurrect the Empire of Charles V. That was the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, first half of the 16th century. Wilhelm I forced, Leopold was his relative, forced Leopold to renounce the Spanish throne. Napoleon III demanded a written statement from Wilhelm promising not to harm the interests of France in the future. It was a deliberately insolent and arrogant thing. Of course, the Prussian king refused to give any guarantees like that. Bismarck had no problem with provoking France to start a war. Wilhelm, in fact, or so the French were told, had refused to discuss the issue with the French ambassador. But mobilization began in France, and the French parliament demanded war by a vote of 245-10. Now, what does this have to do with Russia? July 23rd, Russia's declaration of neutrality was published, demanding that other states do not interfere. It was addressed really to Austria, who continued to want revenge on Prussia. Tsar Alexander II made it clear that the only time Russia would respond would be if they intervened, opening military operations. I mean, if anything, Russia's neutrality was in favor of Prussia. This is ultimately the origin of the Iron and Blood speech. Bismarck's united Germany. The Reichstag of the North German Confederation renamed the state the German Empire. Bismarck's suggestion. 1871, Paris finally capitulated. Elections were held for the National Assembly. There was any German-speaking land, like Lorraine, etc., were transferred to Germany. Of course, France didn't want to accept it. And it was the Russians. It was actually Alexander Gorshakov who kept war from exploding over this. And of course, in 1918, they got it back under the Versailles nonsense. But in the midst of all this, it was the South German states that negotiated with Prussia and joining the North German Confederation. The Russian Tsars, throughout the 19th century, sought to promote the unification of the Germans into the German Empire, for which Russia, in addition to family and dynastic ties, was certainly natural from a political point of view. It ensured the centralized protection of the Christian monarchies from revolutionary France. We spoke of the Holy Alliance on this show in the past, clear cooperation of Germany and Russia, but people often forget the Union of the Three Emperors, 1873 to roughly 1887, uniting Russia and German governments, Austria and Prussia, against the revolution. Austria and German, I should say now. After the outbreak of the Paris Commune in 1871 and murders that it committed, yes, it was only a symbolic challenge, but it was a real one. Alexander II, of Russia, but who wanted the Union more than anyone else. And Joseph I signed a treaty, joined by Germany on October 11th of 1871, the Triple Alliance. The point of this was Russian and German cooperation, controlling Eastern Europe, especially over, things like the Polish question, neutralizing the rivalry between Germany's two neighbors by an agreement over their respective areas of influence. And of course, there's the Balkans. This is where the British realized that they could break this up. Now, there were a few of these League of Three Emperors. ultimately elapsing in 1887, and it was the battle of Austria-Hungary and Russia in the Balkans that destroyed it. There was a more formal Three Emperors Alliance in 1881, but it lapsed in 1887. Again, all due to the same problem. If that union had been stronger, it's hard to believe that Jewish bankers would have been able to provoke the First World War via London. But in addition to the common desire to protect the royal order, and thus peace in Europe, this new union also had specific political interests. Yes, Russia and Germany are natural allies, but there was a problem. Russia was worried about Germany's economic growth, self-confidence, but rather than see it as an enemy, its response was to strengthen positive relations with it. Germany was very much worried about a Russo-French alliance, which is possible from its point of view, given the growth of German political power. Austria, of course, wanted to limit Russia's activity in the Balkans. And on that latter issue, I guess it come down to maintaining the status quo. Unfortunately, it turned out to destroy this pretty natural union, and people often forget the machinations of the British in using the Balkans to destroy the Russo-German alliances. I mean, Bismarck openly supported Austria-Hungary in the Bosnian crisis. The Berlin Congress of 1878, Bismarck supported Austria against Russia, trying to alter the results of the Russo-Turkish War, not in Russia's favor. So it was clear then an Austro-German alliance was concluded directed against Russia. That was a collapse of the Union of Three Emperors. United Germany decided it no longer needed Russia. Unfortunately, you also saw the growth of anti-Russian propaganda in the German press. Fyodor Tuchiev, who I've quoted here many times before, who lived in Germany for a long time, wrote about this Russophobia. But man, you know, I've covered a lot in a very short period of time, so I need to summarize what I'm trying to do here. Concept of trying to look at nations and empires relative to absolute truth. This is a massive sweep of history. If the Jews and their British elite are the farthest from, furthest from the divine truth, then they are, of course, part of bringing the rule of Adam Cadman, the Judaic rule, you know, Great Britain and the USA. Of course, this is not, you know, the Anglo-Saxons themselves are not responsible for it. They're being forced into this by the Jewish elite, very aggressive and talented people, transform the British into an instrument of their democratization of the world. It was Germany, though, that rejected the rational legal principle that developed in Rome after the schism. That rational legal principle eventually led to creation of the kingdom of God on earth just without God, using force for this purpose. Nominalism was a part of this. Religious divisions coming from papalism in Germany kept it from having the role that it should have had in Western Europe. Split of the West from Orthodoxy led to an additional split between Germany and Britain. William of Ockham was a potent example. Thomas Hobbes is another. The Revolution came from Britain. From all of this came the Renaissance, Reformation, Freemasonry, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, of course, Darwinism, and the last stage of postmodernism. Loading up Germany with migrants is essential for the regime, especially now that you have some very good political parties receiving a huge portion of the vote. Of course, you had the same thing in France. We all know where this came from. I know it's not quite the monarchy. Vladimir Putin has filled in, so to speak, as the restrainer. You know, for all his personal problems, for all his sins, for all of our sins, for all the problems with this, you know, the Great Patriotic War and all that. You know, Putin is a Germanophile. He is. He speaks German without an accent. Well, I think that specific aspect is an error. Putin is very pro-German, And again, that should be no surprise. Point is, as far as the regime is concerned, to weaken the restrainer of the world from the onset of the kingdom, the Antichrist, in the Internationale, the communist anthem, it says right in there, no savior delivers from on high. But since the world is lying in evil, these utopias are completely unrealizable. Vladimir Putin has partly regained the mantle of as a restrainer, which is the main reason the regime rains fire and brimstone on him daily. Orthodox Russia remains, for all its problems, the last obstacle to the New World Order, which now is the Great Reset. It's almost inconceivable now that Germany could ever be returned to its natural path, a strong nationalist monarchy. But clearly the regime thinks it's a possibility, or they wouldn't be bringing hundreds of thousands, if not by now, millions of migrants, and banning any mention of the Jews that's not flattering in the popular press. Germany technically isn't even an independent country. It's still under the basic law of the occupation government after World War II. The ultimate goal, the maximal goal, is a Russo-German alliance, just like we had in the past. The Emperor's League, whatever it is, Holy Alliance, against revolution. It's no accident that it was Germany, whether it be Austria or Prussia, or Germany itself, along with Russia. It made sense. There's a reason for this. That is that Germany and Russia are natural allies. It's conceivable that German hatred for the U.S. is growing, since it's really the demand to go along with these stupid sanctions that has destroyed the German economy, led to very high unemployment that's not being reported, and crime has gone through the roof thanks to these migrants. There's a reason those migrants are there. It's not just economic. But historically, building of the centralized Russia and the building of a centralized Germany, well, they had two very different ends. Unfortunately, the religious problem is what destroyed the German version. Didn't have a single church, an Orthodox church, that could promote unity. Although even in the Ottonian dynasty, it was the monks that were very Orthodox, anti-papal, vehemently so, that continued to promote the building of what we call, I guess, the Ottonian Empire. Yes, Germany and Russia are natural allies. And just like more than 100 years ago, the Jews in London and New York are terrified that that may one day be a fact. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.